the first in a series of sessions. Series session is titled Not in That Image of God, William Blake's Contrary Visions of God. And this first one is William Blake, poet, painter, prophet. I think that was the order. It might have been something different, but what I'd like to do today is a couple things. Do a little bit of talking about Blake's life, and then to experience some of his visionary art, which it comes in a variety of forms. So that's why we've got the slide projector set up. And before I do anything, I'd like to begin with a question, and it's a question which I hear frequently in the classroom where I teach at Montana State University in Bozeman. And it's a question I'm hearing even more frequently now at home, now that I've got a verbal two-year-old, and that's the question of why. And it's a question which gets irritating, I think, with the more frequency you get it, and yet I think the question remains important and profound. And in this sense, what I want to talk about is why bother with Blake, a dweeb, as sometimes dead white male poets are called. Why bother with Blake? And I think I've got a couple answers to that question, and maybe some of you do too. Maybe that's why you're here. But one of my answers to why bother with Blake is anybody who was sometimes found by his friends in his backyard with his wife naked, reading Paradise Lost, reenacting the scenes of Adam and Eve before the fall, I think deserves some attention. And that alone, that's enough for me to be interested. Maybe more to the point, though, I think a couple other things that I'd say. Why bother with Blake? Why Blake even at Holden? And one answer to that question is because Blake was an early responder to the problems created for spirituality by the modern world. And he was especially early in that regard, and living at a time when sort of the modern world began. And I think for that reason, he perhaps can give us some insight into that same world that we're in. A couple other reasons, I think, why bother with Blake. And one is because Blake is a literalist. And anytime you use a word to describe Blake, you have to take Blake's own idiosyncrasies into account. So when one calls Blake a literalist, it might mean something different from what we would typically associate with that. But I think he gives new meaning to that, the word literal. And he takes a number of things literally, and certainly he takes some important Christian doctrines literally. And in one sense that means they're very important to him. One is he takes the theme of this summer's program here at Holden very seriously, even literally, and that's men and women are created in God's image. That's central to Blake's thought. Another, he takes Jesus literally, many aspects of Jesus, but especially some of Jesus' parables. If you remember the parable in Luke of the sowers sowing the seed, and at the end of that parable, the disciples don't get it, so Jesus does some explaining. And his line at the end of that is, "Take heed then how you hear." And that is a line that Blake takes literally. Take heed how you hear, how you see, how you listen to anything. Not so much so that you get the dogma correctly, but the next line at the end of that parable where Jesus then says, "To whom much is given, much will be expected." And again, Blake's view of that is, to those of you who have much imagination, much imaginative interpretation of the Bible, of life, will be expected. So take heed how you hear. One other, and I suppose this is even more important than than the Old Testament or Jesus' words, and this Luther's one of Luther's doctrines that the priesthood of all believers, Blake takes quite literally. So he will do it himself. In fact, that's one of the key points about Blake. He will do everything himself to radical extremes. What I'd like to do with this session is then give some biography of who this person was when he lived, talk a little bit about his ideas today, although we'll talk more about his ideas later this week, and then look at some of his poems and illuminations of those poems from Songs of Innocence and Experience. Blake is classified as an English Romantic poet, although that always bothers me to call him a Romantic poet. I teach the 18th century, so I claim him in the 18th century. And I think with good reason. He's a late 18th century poet. 1757 to 1827. In fact, he died August 12th, 1827, so I think it's particularly appropriate to starting this series today. A few things about 18th century context. When I say Blake lived in the era when the modern world began, you hear historians and lots of people say that going all the way back to whenever you want to start. Modern world began and the Renaissance began with the Greeks. And I think all those statements are true, and yet it becomes more true the farther up you get. And in the 18th century is when many of our modern institutions come into being. Just quickly, in politics in England, that's when a lot of their democratic institutions really evolved, and also some of the cynical manipulation of those really was refined. Economics, that's the early beginnings of industrialization in England. Just some of the really early stuff, but certainly the replacement of agriculture and the rise of cities going on with the displacements. Science, it's been changing, but Isaac Newton is one of the predominant people of the time, and sort of typifying the change in attitudes towards looking at the world through scientific perspectives and using scientific method, and also along with that changes in philosophy with John Locke. Objective philosophical emphasis on reason and his business about the mind being a blank slate and absorbing ideas and experiences from the world. Also, two other quickly things that characterize 18th century language. 18th century is a period when English language finally starts to become more regularized and systematized. So Samuel Johnson's first English dictionary gets put together and published, which then tends to start to rigidify things. And also, that's when English prose style becomes much more pragmatic, so that it's simplified and put to specific use. And then in religion, lots of things happening, but certainly in England, dominance of the Anglican Church, rise of deism with the increasing secularization of society, and late in the century, then some of the Methodist revival, which is a particular context for Blake. But Blake was born into this period then, in a middle class family's father made socks, and he was raised to be part of the middle merchant class himself. But looking around at the world that he saw around him, his response was no thanks. And perhaps that's too polite for Blake even. It's not even no thanks, it's no. And most things going around him he did not like. In fact, Blake's whole attitude is extremely critical. It said of him, he never, his only use for any other thinkers is so that he could refute them. And he certainly spent a lot of his time doing that in colorful language. And that's one of the problems for doing any sort of quick discussion summary of Blake. You have to rely on generalizations. And yet for Blake, he says, to generalize is to be an idiot. So it's always with some care that I try to talk about Blake, and that's, in a sense, I could have titled the session an idiot's comments on Blake. So you can take that or leave it. But throughout his life, he was a visionary, a seer, a mystic, someone for whom the spiritual world was as real or more real than the material world that he saw around him, and someone who therefore was seen as very odd by society and even by his friends. He's that odd person that lives in London that it's fun to go talk to because he's so different. And that this visionary aspect of his life led him to see Jesus as a visionary artist. In fact, anybody with any insight worth listening to, he would call a visionary artist. And only through artistic intuition then could deeper reality or truth be perceived by Blake. And Blake's artistic experience was broader than some. He's one of those rare, gifted artists who performed in a number of mediums. Lots of artists have written poetry and painters and vice versa, and yet Blake is one of the few that's as famous for his poetry and his painting. And it's also said that he was a good musician, although the stuff he wrote doesn't survive. So he combined both his painting and his poetry together to produce sort of what we know of it as his work. And just to give you some sense of his visionary qualities, he'd be walking down the street in London and he'd see a tree and all of a sudden it would burst into song with angels singing praises to God. And Blake would record this, be talking to one of his friends, and he'd say, "Wow, look at that." His wife Catherine has said of him that she says, I have very little of Mr. Blake's company. He's always in paradise. I think probably that's why she joined him in the backyard in paradise, so at least she could be with him sometimes. Blake also claimed that his younger brother Robert, who died when Blake was about 25 or something, it was devastating to him, came back from the dead to reveal to Blake information on this printing method that he used to produce his work, and that was words from the other side, and he was very serious about this. And friends would come, this is the one that really gets me, friends would come over to his house and ask him to draw pictures of dead people. And I think Blake is an early channeler, and they'd say, "Would you please draw a picture of John the Baptist for me?" And Blake would sit in his chair with paper, and pretty soon, oh, here he comes. And he would walk into the room, and he'd start sketching John the Baptist. And in one case, he's sketching away, and he stopped, and his friend asked him, "What's wrong? Why have you stopped? You're not done yet." And he said, "Oh, Martin Luther's in the way. I have to wait for him to move." And eventually he moved, and he finished the painting. So you get a feeling for why he was considered odd in his own lifetime, and why in literary studies he was considered clinically mad for a long time. In fact, you still read, people write books about Blake's type of madness, although I think it doesn't make sense to see him as mad clinically. Certainly by, I suppose, normal material world standards, he's odd. His artistic talents were recognized from early on, and so his family sent him to drawing school, thinking to put it to practical use. So when he was 10, he went to drawing school. When he was 14, he was apprenticed to go into business with a reproductive engraver. And this is the age of Hogarth, when engraving is a very important means of visual communication. So artists would paint stuff, and then the engravers would engrave copies of it and sell lots of things. And engravers are doing lots of book illustrations. So that was how Blake was trained. And it was important because that became his livelihood throughout his life. the means by which he supported himself, which wasn't great anyway, but the religious visionary business paid even worse. So, so he was able to make a living and live to be 60 on his engravings. And also his experience in engraving then he put to use when he was doing his own type of illuminations after his brother Robert showed up and explained how to do this new method. Blake wanted to be an important artist. He didn't want to just be an engraver engraving other people's stuff. He wanted to be recognized as an important artist. So he enrolled in the Royal Academy, the sanctioned art society of the day in 1779, which gave him the right to go to the galleries and sketch and to attend lectures. But he didn't stay there long. In fact, he didn't stay in any organization for long. He couldn't. It's constitutionally impossible for him to be in an organization. But he did come into contact there with some of the other artists of his day. And for about 5 years, he exhibited some of his works at the Royal Academy. And then you get criticized in comments by the people in charge. And Sir Joshua Reynolds is the painter that headed up the Academy, and he couldn't stand Blake's stuff. Hardly gave it much notice, but when Blake exhibited stuff, he would give it bad reviews. In fact, finally gave Blake's series of stuff such bad reviews, Blake never went back. In fact, didn't exhibit any of his work publicly for another 15 years. Even though he wasn't appreciated there much, enough people saw his work and the visionary aspects that they recognized that this is a man of genius. So some of his friends got together, pooled some money, and tried to get some of his early poetry published. And then the rest of Blake's life is a series of attempts at making a big impact and depending on how you measure that, failing. But he set up an engraving business, 1784, which fell apart within a year. It was 1785 when he was finally criticized so harshly by Sir Joshua Reynolds that he didn't exhibit for 14 more years. In 1782, he got married and was growing increasingly radical in response to the authoritarianism that he saw going on around him. And again, the changes taking place. And he started hanging out with a group of radicals, particularly Tom Paine, who would soon get booted out of England and for his sympathies to revolution, French Revolution at that time. And also another friend was Mary Wollstonecraft, early feminist. So I think that would have been an interesting group to sit around and listen to. Finally, Blake's individualism culminated in his decision to not go through any other organized intermediaries. He wanted to go to the source, and that's with his religious visionary, he wanted to go to the source with God. And in expressing that, he wanted to go to the people directly. So instead of going through a publisher or engraving stuff and having it printed on a press, he wanted to control every aspect of his art. So he came up with his sort of trademark method of engraving poetry and illustrations of that poetry on the same copper plate, which I'll show some slides, examples of that, which started with the Songs of Innocence, and then he continued to use those methods for 30 years, writing, designing, and printing books himself with no middleman. Sounds like a good way to make money, and yet he would end up only printing 9 copies. And so he never made any money on his art that way. But his method was a new invention of, on a copper plate, writing with a acid impervious material and dipping it and having it bite in the plate and then engraving. So a lot of the stuff he would have to draw backwards and write backwards. And then he would color each plate by hand, and his wife did some of that too, and then print these things. The first successful work of that is the Songs of Innocence and Experience, and I brought a couple of the reproductions of these things if anybody wants to look at them later or anytime during the week. But Songs of Innocence of 1789, which is a collection of short lyrical poems, which don't seem to be direct attacks in the same critical way most of Blake's later stuff is, and yet I think anything in Blake's critical, it just depends on how you read it. What that work eventually became was the Songs of Innocence and Experience, printed together in 1793, which began his focus on human corruption and misery, which he saw all about him. Just a quick bibliography of his other works. Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which I'll spend some more time talking about this week. It's sometimes referred to as the most perfect book written in the English language. And I don't know if that's true. I don't believe superlative statements like that. And yet, I certainly find it one of the most fascinating. Some of his other works, America in 1793, Europe 1794, those are both about revolutions. Visions of the Daughters of Albion, Milton and his great late epics, Milton, the Four Zoas, which is almost unreadable, and Jerusalem. The evidence of his success as an artist can be measured a couple different ways, certainly by his fame now, but in his own time, he did about 1,400 designs for commercial projects, so he was used in his own day. That's doing book illustrations and things. Although, people found very quickly, you'd ask Blake to do a book illustration, and it wouldn't come back like you would expect. So you've got this story. And he illustrated Dante's Inferno, and he'd get the proofs back for these things, and there's a picture of hell, and there's a sun down there in hell, and there's these people inside the sun. You just imagine these publishers and writers saying, Blake, you know, what is this stuff? and part of the reason, his obstinacy in saying, well, that's what's really there. They say, but that's not in the story. Say, of course it's in the story. Be careful how you read. And so he didn't get a lot of your standard issue illustration assignments. But later in his career, he got to illustrate some big important works paid for by people interested in sort of the growing romantic movement, seeing maybe there were some connections. But he also did, let's see, about 1,000 pictures for patrons that wanted his art. And then about 400 plates for his own stuff. And his wife, Catherine, said of him, she never saw his hands idle except when he was in conversation or reading. So he worked hard, and his typical routine would be to work at his engraving business all day. He'd go to bed, and then he'd wake up at night with an idea, and then he'd get up and work all night on his poetry and own art. Later in life, then, when he was approaching 60, a younger generation did become interested in him, and that's when he got commissions to illustrate Virgil, Job, and the Divine Comedy. And as I said before, he died August 12th, which is 164 years ago, I think. My math was right. So that's quick biography. I think Blake's biography is interesting insofar as we know details about it, and like any biographies, it's questionable whether all those stories end up being true or not, but I guess for Blake, it doesn't matter. if we think it's true. And just a couple keys to his thinking, to his ideas. And one comment that's made about Blake is he's so great a Protestant, no church could hold him. He carries on the Reformation tradition of Protestantism, protesting against everything, including the organization in which he found himself. And he couldn't go to a typical organized church of his day. He was interested in some of the new churches that were evolving, although he'd go to those and he'd quickly find out it was too much of the same old thing, and he would leave. And I think the most important generalization, if I could risk one, you could say about Blake is that he hated conventional authority of any kind. Conventional authority is the enemy in life, and it's all the repercussions of that, I think, are what makes Blake fascinating, and especially so that therefore he wanted to go to the source, to get away from any conventional interpretations. He took that to such an extreme that I think that's one of the reasons why literary critics for years thought he was mad. And think about this, if convention of any type is the enemy, when he's writing books, one edition of Songs of Innocence and Experience, he'll put the plates together in a certain order. But to keep that from being conventional, next one he prints up, he'll say, oh, well, shuffle the order of the poems in Songs of Innocence. And then he'll even shift some of what were Songs of Innocence to Experience and Experience to Innocence to see what would happen. And in his later works, and all of them are colored differently, and in his later works then, narrative conventions become the enemy. So he's constantly violating conventions of time, narrative, in his work. So they'll be telling some story, sort of, about a character, Loss. All of a sudden that character's name and significance will change, and he'll never tell you what he's done. It'll just happen like that, and then leave you to figure it out. So characters change roles. Blake's a very symbolic poet, and yet the meaning of the symbols he uses changes. You can't write a dictionary of Blake symbols, although everybody does, and it's useful to a point. But you can't look up, okay, what does this mean when I'm reading Blake so I can understand what, when he thinks experience, what does that mean? Because that will change from poem to poem. And that's what makes his later works extremely difficult to read, because you've got no guide, no map, other than his whole way of thinking about things. This last point here, and let's do some looking at some of his works. Mythology to Blake is the literal reality. If Blake's a literalist, what he's a literalist of is myth. And that's what he's interested in reading the Bible's myths and producing. So in all of his poetry, he's writing myths. And that is stories of these figures that he's invented or that walked by that he saw, there they are, and he's describing them. And to get at truth. And as Blake says, the nature of my work is visionary or imaginative. It's an endeavor to restore what the ancients called the Golden Age. He's trying to get back to Eden, and that is the Eden before the Eden organized religion typically thinks of. And we'll talk more, for those of you who are around tomorrow, about Blake's visions of God and what that means, but Blake deals with visionary, mythic stuff. Songs of Innocence and Experience is lyric poetry, so it's a little bit different, but we'll get to more of the myths tomorrow. What I'd like to do is a sort of a multimedia presentation, since Blake is a multimedia person. I've got a audio cassette of someone performing some of Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience, which you might have heard. It even got some radio play back in 88 when they came out, or 87. It's Greg Brown of Prairie Home Companion fame, if you know Greg Brown. He's produced some of Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience, which I think it's a good rendition. And since Blake himself composed music and performed these things for his friends, I think it makes perfect sense. So what I'd like to do, I've got a few slides to show you, just to give you the other side of Blake, and then I'll play some of these poems, and we'll look at the text on the screen as we go, and then have some time to try to figure out what Blake's up to.
But the music isn't historically connected with any Blake music. Right?
No, this is just someone else's interpretation. Before I hook these on, has anybody any questions about anything I was just saying or about sort of fitting Blake in still? Let's see if we can see this stuff.
The light.
You could almost pick anybody from the 18th century, flash them up there, and say, that's Blake's enemy. And this is Sir Joshua Reynolds self-portrait, head of the Royal Academy, who Blake did not like and criticized extensively in his writings. This is the type of art that Reynolds was painting that was popular at the time, portrait painting of people with money and sort of just with figures that blended into the background, not lots of definition and not enough focus on the human figure for Blake. That's the dominant taste of the day. And this is Blake's. Now there's a portrait. If you're gonna buy a portrait in a studio, which one are you gonna pick? Says this is what the spiritual essence of fleas look like. And he came through and he talked to me. And his friend said, well, did you paint a picture of it? And he said, no. He said, well, let's hang around, maybe he'll come back. And pretty soon he did, so then he painted a couple different versions of this flea, and the original is really quite stunning with sort of gold. You can't really get the effect here, but Blake's, what he said was that sort of the soul of bloodthirsty politicians and people after they die would inhabit fleas, and that they go around biting people, and that it was a good thing they were in insects, otherwise the world would be depopulated if they were entered horses or something. And this is God for Blake. That's the creator God in all its mystery. And that's God acting like Isaac Newton with his compasses figuring out the geometry of the world. And then I've got some pictures from the Songs of Innocence and Experience up here. Let me flash through these and then we'll listen to a couple of the poems and get a chance to hear your response. So this is 1793 when he put the two together. And I mean, there you've got sort of Adam and Eve after the fall getting blasted. And some of these slides are professional reproductions. Some of these are ones I took in my living room last week, so I think you can tell the difference. It's a little bit of glare. That's the frontispiece to the Songs of Innocence then. And that's just the basic theme of innocence and experience. You've got this piper piping these innocent songs to children, about children, for children in the Songs of Innocence. Sort of that's your innocent visionary experience. And in the Songs of Experience, you've got a cynical, critical, Blake-type bard who sees things as they really are, though the question is, which way are they really?
Is there a subtitle for Songs of Innocence? The one before that?
Yeah.
Like something about human emotion?
Yeah, it's showing the two contrary states of the human soul. That's... And let me just flip through this first just to give you an idea of Blake's methods of illumination. You can see how the poetry, you can't really read it, but poetry and the illustrations are completely integrated. And that was quite new at the time. And it's Holy Thursday and Divine Angels, poems. And then this is a frontispiece to this Songs of Experience. The winged little cherub in innocence, you saw, was floating up above, sort of this spiritual inspiration, and now it's come down to earth. In fact, to be inspired, you have to sort of wrestle inspiration and keep it on your head. And then people lamenting over the death of somebody. Okay, these next three are the ones that I'd like to concentrate on. The Tiger, that's Blake's most famous poem. Most of you heard or read or...
Tiger,
yeah,
Brown, right?
That's it. Let's listen to Greg Brown playing Tiger.
Dear mother, the church is cold.
And I don't, could you understand the words on the tape very well? Is that possible? I get blinded if I stay here.
Well, turn off the light.
Is the question really you ask of most modern art, and Blake is a modern artist in that sense, is, well, it looks nice, but what the heck is it? And those two poems, how are we to sort of measure what's going on in Poison Tree? You want me to read that one more time so you can hear that? Turn down the fuzz. Tell me what you think that means, and I think that's an exceedingly important question for Blake because of his dictum from the gospel, be careful how you hear, and that's a question I think, it's intimidating when you read Blake because what is this stuff, and yet I think Blake gives you very great deal of leeway in responding to that question, and what he's encouraging is individual responses to what does this stuff mean? What he wants is imaginative response. So let me read Poison Tree again, that's if I can find it. Okay. I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath. My wrath did end. I was angry with my foe. I told it not, my wrath did grow. And I watered it in fears, night and morning with my tears, and I sunned it with smiles and with soft, deceitful wiles, and it grew both night and day, till it bore an apple bright. And my foe beheld it shine, and he knew that it was mine. And into my garden stole, when the night had veiled the pole, in the morning, glad I see my foe outstretched beneath the tree. And then you've got the illustration, this dead guy under the tree. Any associations there? What you know of Blake or any of this other stuff that I've said about Blake? Any comments?
Well, there's absolute good and bad. The hatred is utterly lethal. If it's allowed to be fostered,
Yeah, and that's sort of Blake's early Freudian. Even that's you tell your hatred in psychoanalysis, then you're better. And that's I think that makes sense. If you hold it in, it becomes something.
And there's no gray area for Blake, right? It's absolute.
Yeah,
evil, absolute good.
Yeah, he thinks in terms of contraries, the two contraries of the human soul. So there's innocence and there's experience. And it's one or the other, but those things can always change. But you're right about the middle, yeah.
Well, what's the line, does his resentment turns into the fruit, the apple, and then, what was the line about, and then saw that and he smiled?
Yeah, so he was angry, he didn't tell it, he watered the anger, and then that anger grew into an apple.
Literally grew an apple.
And then the foe that he was angry with saw that nice apple, came in and stole it and ate it.
And knew it was his. And
yeah.
Stole it.
Stole it and died. Does that ring any...
The friend stole the apple, and then it was the enemy.
The enemy came in, stole it.
Stole the apple.
Knowing it was...
Ate it, and then died.
Yeah.
So that's bizarre, because the original emphasis is how it was bad for the person to have this resentment that turned into such hatred.
Yeah.
But then if the person, your enemy, then eats the apple and dies, then it's actually good.
Or at least your enemy's dead.
He didn't say it was bad. He didn't say anything about being bad. He just talked about the process that occurred.
Right.
Yeah, so if you speak your wrath, it's gone. If you hold it in, it turns into something, and it turns into something physical, which has physical consequences.
So in terms of magic, in a sense, that would be the recipe for creating a poison apple, is hold your anger inside and water it with your tears.
And psychological thoughts having physical consequences, and that's sort of Blake's mystical dictum, that those are true, yeah.
Maybe it also says something about death, that there's more than one kind of death. It doesn't have to be a physical death. You can psychologically slay someone, so to speak.
Yeah. And whether, and I think it is interesting, whether it's good for the speaker of this that his enemy's dead, that type of death, does that mean that's beneficial, or is that just more evil?
And if you're talking about what you said, and what I've already told you about, so I mean, I was thinking about, you know, him and his wife in the backyard.
Right.
He thought about this a lot, about paradise and stuff. Mm-hmm. And we got the apple, you know, in the thing. Well, if Adam ate the apple and they died, that God made that apple out of the anger, of God's anger.
Right.
So God slew Adam and Eve.
I think that's one of the primary contexts for this poem. And for the fall, Adam and Eve, he's always got on his mind. And what does that mean? God's mad at Adam?
Had resentment against Adam. Didn't tell Adam.
Yeah, and that gives you a new perspective on the whole sort of fall story, and I think that's exceedingly important to sort of Blake's cosmology, and I'll show some more slides and talk about that tomorrow in detail. But I think that's, in my understanding of this poem, really what's here. He's telling a story about biblical creation.
Is that a dark side of God then?
Yeah, that's God at enmity with human beings. Mm-hmm.
Is there any possibility that the friend, though, to whom he told his wrath, are Adam and Eve instead, and that it is, in fact, the ultimate enemy, Satan, who is the one who is finally slain?
But Satan would not, in Blake's realm, would not be considered necessarily an enemy.
Well, that's, yeah, and again, Satan, God, all those terms for Blake don't quite mean the same thing that we think of when we use them. And that's, I guess, one way I would think about sort of those terms, God, Satan, and this. I mean, here you've got organized religion's God and organized religion's treatment of creation story. Adam and Eve, the fall, this God that punishes human beings for exercising their desires, and for Blake, exercising human desire is holy. That's what's perfect about being human, is being human and exercising that desire. So that God isn't God. In fact, when you bring up Satan, that God for Blake, really, this God is Satan for Blake. The God of organized religion and traditional Eden myth isn't God, Blake's saying. That's Satan. This is Satan that was angry with this man and woman, so made this plot, put a poison tree out there, and killed them. Yeah.
If you look at it perhaps a different way, at least part of what was saying earlier about the telling of the anger and this dissipating, and then a different character comes where you have where the anger is not dissipated, and the enemy knows that you've created this anger and is willing to bite it and eat it and die. Mm-hmm. In a sense, then there's no reconciliation possible, and so then the ultimate outcome of that is continuous war, because the enemy has died. In a sense, not really, but in a sense has eaten what you wanted to share. And so then it becomes sort of a story about oppression and how we work it out in a society where war doesn't stop. We the enemy is willing to go along with our hatred and willing to continue the conflict, which gets away from the biblical idea that you were working, but if he was interested in social justice,
right, that's right.
Then that might be a more working with that kind of concept.
Yeah, and that's, I think Blake's always got the Bible in mind, but that's certainly not his only context. I think it's exactly right to think about it, other places. But even taking what you were saying back through the Bible, the enemy here, that's Adam eating the apple as sort of the Jesus sacrifice, sort of sacrificing himself for, I mean, fighting against oppression. And certainly that's how Blake saw himself, fighting against oppression. That's how he views what Jesus is up to, fighting oppression. And the oppression that Jesus is fighting is the oppression of this image of a father God.
Is there any suggestion of that? Is that a plausible reading, that there's a Christ, that the enemy who dies after eating the apple is the new Adam?
Well, I think so. Just even from the illustration, he's under the tree with his arms outstretched like Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's Jesus, the ultimate man.
Mm-hmm. Victim of the wrathful father.
Yeah. Right.
Is Blake, can it be historically demonstrated that he in some ways connected to earlier Gnosticism, Manichaeism, dualism of that sort?
Yeah, very much.
Through what line?
He liked Swedenborg probably longer than he liked anyone else.
Yeah.
Swedenborg himself is much a derivative of this whole line of tradition, but is it medieval dualism that he's inheriting?
Well, I think Blake gets it from Swedenborg and Bowen, however you pronounce it, Jacob
Böhme?
Yeah, that's it.
Jacob Böhme?
Yeah, he did some reading of that and Swedenborg, and that's where I think he gets most of it. Plus, he just, however you talk about sort of archetypal mystics, they do the same thing, and that's, and I think much of it comes from Swedenborg, but that's, and certainly Marriage, Heaven, and Hell, which we'll talk more about tomorrow too, even. He's got Swedenborg on his mind constantly. Which, Marriage, Heaven, and Hell is written about the same time as Songs of Experience, so this is the same time as this poem. Yeah.
I was just wondering if he saw organized religion as an enemy to this life. Would he see if that was Jesus that's laying there, that ate the apple and died, it was a sacrifice? Would it be a sacrifice to right the wrathful father that organized religion has painted? Or did he see God as being wrathful?
What he saw was sort of ultimate truth. Jesus is the God for Blake. This sort of father, wrathful God figure is around and has all kinds of force, so is there, but that's sort of what happened is that God shows up at the fall. So the creation, you've got true Adam and Eve, perfect living in perfect Eden. Then there's some type of fall that takes place. After that fall, what happens is the Father Sky God gets set up in heaven and then worshiped by these fallen individuals, thinking, worshiping the object, their oppressor, thinking that that's their father, and Jesus is sort of outside that fallen sort of savior. And again, if the priesthood of all believers, or that individuals are God for Blake, it's hard to pin him down on what extreme that gets carried to, but he does say all deities reside in the human breast. Doesn't necessarily mean deities are sort of just projections, but, and that's carrying a sort of priesthood of all believers to a very extreme. So you are Jesus, you are God. Certainly that's true for Blake. So that you can reverse the fall if you think properly.
But was God also one physical being?
The view of God as the Ancient of Days with his compasses, external to human beings, is a symptom of error. So God is, I mean, I don't know if you talk about God, one physical being. God is the spiritual thing that connects people to Blake.
If you look at that poem again as the poem about human beings. It's a human being as a creator.
Mm-hmm.
That's an organic sort of image, that tree growing up out of the person's hatred.
Yeah.
It also sounds like Jesus reconciles God to us instead of Jesus reconciling us to God.
Yeah, I think that's right. And
is that right? Is there a whole, does he want to reconcile that awful God either in either direction?
Not the awful God, but the God behind that God, and that's, and ultimately that's the God in yourself.
Yeah, but the creator God, you know, in Nasi, in Yaldabaoth, is really the embodiment of negativity, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there would be no desire to be reconciled with that God, would there be?
The only thing is that God serves a function for Blake that has value. It's not all the collection of negativism, because after the fall, something has to happen, or sort of in Blake's view, this myth is you keep falling and falling and falling forever. So his God, Nobo Daddy, nobody's daddy, he refers to him sometimes as, at least creates the material universe and creates Adam and Eve's physical bodies so that we've got a place to work from. And that's beneficial. In fact, so then his Jesus, as being sort of the incarnate combination of spirit and physical matter, has some place to work with too. And that's,
so he doesn't deny the, as you said, the beauty of the physical and the validity of human experience.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't be a Gnostic ultimately.
Right, and that's the marriage of heaven and hell, or the doctrine of contraries. He wants both body and soul together in some sort of radical union, which Jesus, I think, for Blake, is the best expression of whatever that means. And that's the poem, The Tiger, too, that we had up there. That ambivalence, is the tiger's terrible, horrible, tiger is wonderful, desirable, it's both. It's not just good and evil. Blake sort of rejects the terms good and evil and wants his own terms. But I don't want to run over today, so we're officially ended. If you want to hang around at all and ask me another question or something, I'd be happy to talk some more.
Thank you.